Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Aldana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, both the stock and bond markets have recovered somewhat this summer amid some hopeful signs that inflation has maybe peaked. Cross your fingers, knock on wood, all that. So is this awful period for investors finally over, or was this just a summer head fake? We'll get into it with not one but two expert guests this week. But first, Aldana, I have to warn you, I'm a bit of an emotional train wreck today.
How's that different from usual?
not very different. Not very different. Even more of an emotional train wreck this week. My daughter, in less than 24 hours, goes off to college. I'll be dropping her off at university. And I'm not so much worried about her. I'm worried that I somehow messed up the paperwork or I sent the money to the wrong place and that sort of thing. So
yeah, I worry about that for you also.
Yeah.
But I'm sure she's gonna have so much fun. For you, it'll be tough, but for her, it'll be really fun.
We'll see. We'll see. I hope so. It's very tough for me. But luckily, you know, we do have on the show this week a very famous university professor. So maybe when he's done giving us his market insights, he can give me some insights on how not to go crazy as the father of a university student. I don't know if it's possible. I think it's just my destiny to go nuts now at this point in life.
No, I think you should let your feelings be felt. But you're right. We do have a professor on the show this week. I'm so happy he can join us. It's Jeremy Siegel. He's professor emeritus of finance at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And he's WisdomTree's senior investment strategy advisor. And then we have a second Jeremy on the show, Jeremy Schwartz. He's global chief investment officer at WisdomTree. So thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
A Philly guy, you know, I'm always happy to have a Philly connection on the show. I'm an old Philly guy myself, professor. So
he'll ask you cheesesteak questions later.
Yeah. Well, I've been here for 46 years. I was actually born in Chicago, so I'm a Midwesterner.
Yeah.
You haven't converted to full Philly yet?
Yeah, I have. I have because you know my sons grew up here and. Then you become a Philly sports fan, and then you're Philly.
Go Birds! Go Birds!
Yeah.
Professor Siegel, maybe we start with you. I wanted to ask you what you're expecting from the Fed for the rest of this year. And I wanted to ask you if you can walk us through how you're thinking about what the Fed should be doing and how your thinking about that has changed in recent weeks or months.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, what they do and what they should do are not necessarily the same thing. At this particular point, I think what they should do is on a slightly less aggressive side. I think given the data we have so far, now, again, as data rolls in, you know, things can change. But given the data we have so far, I don't think they should go more than an extra 100 basis points through the end of the year. The funds market, if I take a look at the January funds, which basically, you know, takes care of what's going to happen at year end, is 362 now. So they think it's going to be an extra 125 basis points or even a little bit more. Now, a lot of people are surprised at my recommendation since I was certainly a super hawk and warned about inflation probably earlier than any other forecaster or economist. The reason that I am recommending on the light side here is because when I look at inflation on the ground, not in the formal statistics published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but actually what is happening in the active markets, in the markets that the prices are determined every day, commodity markets, energy markets, and particularly even the housing market. I see declining prices. I do not really see rising prices. Does not mean that we will not see rising prices in the consumer price index because of the way it's constructed is very lagged to what is actually going on out there. Nevertheless, I think the increase has taken place so far and what the market anticipates, and that's built in, has dramatically slowed the money supply. In fact, the money supply has shrunk since March, which is almost an unprecedented occurrence. And as a result, although there is inflation in the pipeline, particularly the statistical pipeline, my feeling is we should not get overly aggressive at this point. I see inflation as peaking in the real world, although will remain high in the statistics.
Yeah, Professor, I wonder how you're thinking about the market in that scenario then. Is the idea of the Fed continuing to tighten, but at a sort of less aggressive pace, is that a reason to be bullish on the stock market? It does seem, you know, valuations are a little high. Earnings growth estimates are not, you know, really that robust. And, you know, there is this overall concern about whether we really be able to achieve that soft landing that the Fed hopes to achieve. Is a less aggressive Fed enough to sort of be very bullish about the stock market, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very reasonably priced. I've maintained for a long time that I think under normal circumstances, the market should be selling for about 20 times forward 12-month earnings. Yeah. We're below that at the present time.
Or about 18 or so now, right?
Yeah. So I think that, and it doesn't mean, I mean, it's going to fluctuate between like 12 and 28 or,
yeah.
I mean, you know, we all know that. But I think 20, I know the historical is slightly less, like 17 or so. But we live in a different world with a lower general level of interest rates and a higher level of liquidity. And I think that really does call for a slightly higher than historical level. So as a result, I do not think the market is overvalued at the present time. It's not grossly undervalued by any means, but I do not think it is overvalued.
And Jeremy, I want to bring you in here as well. And before we talk about how you would maybe recommend investors be positioned in the current environment, I want to ask you about how high you think the hurdle is for the so-called Fed pivot to even happen, which is something we've been hearing so much about over the last couple of weeks, basically this entire summer, where investors have been sort of fighting the Fed is the phrase that we keep hearing.
You know, and I'll give Professor Siegel so much credit. I mean, he was the one calling for them to be hawkish. Now he's calling them to be dovish. All you hear from the Fed is that inflation's high and it's going to be a problem. You don't hear them backing off in any of their communications. You've got people like Kashkari out saying with these 8% numbers, we got to keep raising rates. So the sort of raise and hold seems to be a lot of the taglines. And I think Professor Siegel is going to keep pushing them to rethink that. So I think that it'll be very interesting to see how quickly they can come down and how much they're going to actually see that inflation in the pipeline versus looking at those backward looking statistics that the professor keeps talking about.
You know, Jeremy, I'm fascinated with some of the ETFs at WisdomTree because it's some very sophisticated sort of strategies. I'm looking at some of the best best performing this year over the past year. The Enhanced Commodity Strategy Fund, the U.S. Dollar Bullish Fund. Walk us through, you know, and feel free to use your own ETFs as an example of how you do think, the best way to be positioned is in this environment. I mean, boy, if I could go back in time and buy the Commodity Strategy Fund and the U.S. Dollar Bullish Fund, be actually having a good year. So it's interesting that you have such a wide variety of different options to choose from. What do you think is the best place to go right now?
You know, so very interestingly, you know, for the Fed, you know, the one of the things that we're seeing a lot of interest in is sort of floating rate treasuries. And for the idea of, I'd still be cautious on duration. You know, we might think rates don't have a lot further to go, but with the inverted curve, you could get very good short-term rates and not taking any of that duration risk. So our USFR floating rate treasury fund is now our largest ETF, over $7 billion. And that I'd say is for the best play for the Fed in the bond market. And so that continues to be a very focused fund. Just core staple reflecting the short-term interest rates with a one-week duration. Within equities, you know, certainly there's been a huge factor rotation from the expensive growth stocks towards value, and in no better than one of the original ETFs WisdomTree launched 16 years ago, DHS, high dividends, has been significantly positive on the year. And that is, you know, compared to even value stock. I mean, value has outperformed growth. Growth has lagged. The most expensive growth has lagged the most. But high dividends being positive, you know, obviously energy is a part of that, but it's not only energy. I mean, it's less than 20% energy. And so the high dividend stocks in every sector are outperforming the lower dividend stocks in every sector. So a really diversified way to get high dividend stocks. You know, the commodities and the dollar, I think, are very interesting because often you would have, there was a negative correlation and you thought you needed a down dollar for commodities to do well. You could say that may be one of the things suppressing gold is the very strong dollar and higher interest rates that you've gotten this year. You know, gold did well when you had negative interest rates. But, you know, the dollar continues to go on momentum. It's partly been a rates trade. When you look at, say, the pound and the euro, you know, it's actually trading more with the energy crisis. You know, because if you look at the pound in particular, their rates were rising and the pound's been falling. So there's a lot of interesting stuff in the dollar. You know, we're one of the first people to do currency hedged ETFs. It's very interesting. You still haven't seen meaningful flows to those. You've seen flows to the dollar. Even just this week, we saw flows come to the dollar coming back towards highs. The currency hedging, people are still betting on the euro, the yen, and all their traditional international funds, which is surprising to me. But the dollar has been very, very strong on the higher Fed rates.
I was looking into that. You know, it was amazing a few years ago, your hedged European equities ETF that was just attracting assets like crazy. I think it went over $20 billion at one point. I guess, is it just all these anomalies in the market, sort of that, you know, dollar rising with commodities and people sort of shying away from the hedged equities? Is it all, I guess it all just relates back to the Ukraine war and just, you know, the energy crisis has just created an almost, you know, unique situation historically. Yep. that is very tricky to position for. Does that seem to be sort of the driving, you know, force behind all the trends you've seen?
In Europe, I'd say yes, the sentiment towards Europe generally has been not people increasing flows. I mean, I'm surprised in Japan too. I mean, the yen sort of skyrocketed. I mean, just a few, if you go back not so long, it was like 103 yen to the dollar. Now 138, 137 yeah. yen to the dollar. Huge move. And a lot of it happened very, very quickly. Again, on this sort of rising rate differential between the U.S. and sort of Bank of Japan. So I think it caught a lot of people off guard, and it surprised people how quickly it moved. And so I and a lot of people just haven't felt like they knew what to do with currencies, and they defaulted to what they used to do versus to, like, the, you know, the position in those funds doesn't have a currency play. They're neutral to currency, so they don't benefit when currencies go up, and they don't get hurt when they go down. And so that's something I've been talking a lot about, of you don't have to bet on these foreign currencies. You could just buy the cheap stocks. Japanese stocks, 9x earnings, 11% wow. earnings yields, one of the cheapest value plays around relative to where their bond yields are. You know, and you don't have to take the currency risk, which is my, you know, I think a good thing people can do.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions. Alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
And Professor, just to come back to you and an interview I heard of yours, a recent interview of yours that I've heard, you said that you think that we're already in a mild recession. And I was hoping you can tell us more about that.
Well, you know, technically, and a sort of rule of thumb, a recession is two declining quarters of real GDP. And according to the official statistics, we've had them first and second quarter. And that's what I meant. Now, I don't think it's going to be called a recession. The National Bureau of Economic Research, as you know, which is a private research organization, not the government, does make the official determination months later, and they look at much more than just the GDP. But I was saying that it looked like we were in a real, if not a outright recession, a growth recession, which, by the way, it looks like it's continuing in this quarter. Estimates that I get are between 0 and 1. You know, we're not just over halfway through the quarter. We don't have really data for July. But nonetheless, we've had an unprecedented drop in GDP while at the same time having robust labor market growth, which is absolutely unheard of in history. We've added 3.2 million jobs on payroll and GDP has gone down, how is that possible? What are these people doing? Are they twiddling their thumbs? Or are they claiming they're working at home 8 hours when they're working at home for 4 hours? I don't know. But we have something that we have never had before. And I mean, 75 years of statistics, we've never had growth of the labor force and declining GDP before. And the magnitudes are absolutely stunning. And I certainly hope, I think the Fed and the Biden administration should be working on this problem of how do we have all these people, new hires, and yet falling GDP. It is a collapse of productivity in the data that is, again, unprecedented. And I mean it by almost orders of magnitude, we have not seen anything like this.
You know, Professor, you wrote a very, very famous, well-regarded book, Stocks for the Long Run, in the middle of the 1990s. And I think in that and since then, you've sort of been an advocate, more of a fan of stocks than bonds, but also very much an advocate for diversifying internationally. I'm just curious, you know, the world has changed so much over the last few years, you know, starting with the trade war with China, now the Ukraine-Russia situation. It almost seems like the trend towards globalization been damaged, perhaps irreparably, at least in our lifetimes. Has that made you change your thinking at all about being diversified in international equities at this point in the game?
Well, Mike, you're certainly correct. And in fact, I would say my biggest disappointment is the performance of international stocks and even emerging market stocks. The way where the world was going 20 years ago, growth outside the United States was 3 to 4 times the growth in the U.S. Half the world's equities were here. I thought by this time, only about a quarter or a third of the world's equities are here. But it turns out that still half of the world's equity values are here in the U.S. Yes, it has been my greatest disappointment. And yes, I'm worried about China. There's a lot of negatives there. You know, we can talk about Europe. The only saving grace for international investors at this point, I mean, Jeremy just referred to it, is their incredibly low valuation. So you're getting paid for slower growth. I mean, what is Europe allowing 11 times earnings? And as you said, Japan is no different in emerging markets. Also, very low teens with dividend yields of 4%, 5%, 6%. So even if they don't go up in price, you're getting a darn good return. So, yes, they've disappointed. Yes, They may not grow as fast as the U.S. going forward, but their very low valuations, to me, suggest that you should not abandon them at the low in your portfolio.
And Mike, if I could add to that real quickly, you know, because the sixth edition professor is coming out. So make sure people know in September, the new edition is coming out. A lot of updates.
Dr. Longron, sixth edition. The biggest, I'm interrupting Jeremy, it's the biggest change by far of any. There's five new chapters, big expansions there's four chapters on value investing just by itself.
Yeah.
Where there used to be just one chapter before. Yes, Jeremy, you want to continue on that?
Talk about talking your book, Professor. Boy, that's how it though for a guy of your stature.
Yeah, I just want to say that a lot of these topics are discussed there.
Oh, good. Look forward to it.
Well, the point I was going to make is in the book we talk about. The growth is not return is one of the key equations and sort of, you know, why did value do well? So some of the best performing countries didn't have the fastest growth. You know, if there was a negative correlation between growth and return in some of those international markets, and that's, you know, reflected in those low valuations is that often people become too pessimistic about growth and they low value those. And then over time, those become the long-term winners. So I think that's.
Let me just give you, people are shocked. They go over the last 100 years, you know, ask what is the best stock market performance in dollar terms. And you tell them it's South Africa and they look at you like you're crazy. And South Africa has had one of the slowest GDP growths of all the countries, but its valuation has always been so low that you've made it up on valuation, what you didn't get in growth. We also tell the story about IBM and Standard Oil of New Jersey, now Exxon Mobil. IBM has had much faster growth in dividends, earnings, and all the components, but its total return has not matched that of Exxon Mobil over the last 50 or 60 years. So again, growth does not necessarily mean return. In the short run, it does power superior return, but a long run often leads to too high valuations, and the slow and steady get it done for you in the long run.
Jeremy, maybe you can talk a little bit more about valuations, because the other big thing that we had been hearing all summer is that earnings expectations were way too high, that they were needing to be coming down. And I'm wondering what you make of that talk and how you guys are thinking about it.
You know, it's interesting, and I think this has been one of the surprises, given all the professor said on the pressure on the economy, yet earnings have come in strong. Like, where is the recession in the earnings data? And even more so, you know, what Mike brought up, hey, your strong dollar fund has been one of the best performing funds this year. If you go back, you know, there's been a few different estimates. The Mike Wilson at Morgan Stanley put out an estimate that a 16-point move in the dollar recently translates to an 8% earnings headwind, that because a lot of the multinationals, tech companies in particular, have earnings overseas. Strong dollar makes translation worse. You saw that in IBM, you saw that in Netflix, you saw that in Pepsi, all the consumer staple stocks. And yet earnings are still strong, right? So I think that is one of the interesting points on how, you know, obviously the rest of the year will be important. Can earnings continue to come in well? But they have held up remarkably well in the face of the dollar, in face of the slowing GDP. And so that'll be one thing to see play out. And I think that also goes to the benefit we just talked about international. I think that over the next few years, you could actually see Europe and Japan become more competitive as global exporters. Certainly, they're facing this huge, both of them importing energy is a very big labor, very big import cost, but their labor is becoming way more competitive. And I just heard an anecdote yesterday that you could get a Japanese employee for 1,750 yen, which four times college, you know, four years of college education, very different rates, you know, and becoming way more competitive. So I think that's also the case for some of the internationals, that their labor market's becoming way more competitive than they were even historically with the weak currencies.
Let me supplement that also by saying, you know, everyone says, oh, the far out estimates are too high. The far out estimates are always too high. If you go a year into the future, and then, you know, I think we have 25 years of S&P estimates going out. In 90% of the years, the year out estimate is too high and is brought down. It's just the individual annual. It's just like, you know, they put in 10, 12, 14%. And then every month it just goes down and down and down. The only few times when it goes up is you're at the turning point of a severe recession. It surprises you on the upside and you'll get an upside surprise. So, you know, people telling me those estimates of 2023 are too high. I'll say, what else is new? You know, do I see a collapse? No. And Jeremy mentioned the fact that, you know, the first half of this year, negative GDP growth, and yet earnings, and that really beat the second half of last year. I don't know if we'll, I'm not going to say never, but, you know, 2021 was just unbelievable blockbusters. I mean, you know, we were 20, 25, 30% over. You're not going to match that performance in 2022 or 2023. I think we'd be happy with 5-6%. You know, real growth of earnings going forward. And that will still produce a return on stocks that'll far beat fixed income assets.
You know, Professor, another thing I wanted to ask you about is in recent years, we've seen the growth of retail traders as really a pretty important force in markets. You know, what we call the meme stocks, the GameStops and the AMCs and the Bed Bath & Beyonds. You know, I suppose at least in part due to, you know, the elimination of commissions on trading has created a more of a gambling environment. I'm curious how you're thinking about that. Have the markets changed forever, do you think? Is this a fad? You know,
First of all, you know, let's take AMC, Bed Bath and Beyond, GameStop. Their total market value is what? 0.5% of stocks or less?
Right.
And even add a few more memes, you're still getting an absolutely infinitesimal part of the market. Now, they may look like there's a lot of fireworks there. There's a lot of movement. If you're into gambling and you like that, fine, go to it. And I was asked to meet Stiles a year ago, and I said, somewhat conservatively, I do not think they will be rewarding to long-term investors.
Right.
I'm going to make the same statement there. They're gambling vehicles, you know, as more than anything else. Have they changed? I mean, the groups that are attracted to that sort of gambling, of course, part of gambling, you can make things more exciting with options as people do. Fine. But, you know, I always recommend to young people, if you want to pay with 10 or 15% of your portfolio in those games, fine. But, you know, put the other 85 into some sort of an indexed long term fund that will have meaning for you when you finally become an adult.
If ever.
I don't want to diminish that when I say finally become an adult, because some of these are adults. And by the way, some people know how to play these markets. So I don't want that negative. I say when you become retired, like I am. you are an adult in most cases. I don't know what the minimum age for actually making a brokerage account is, but as I said, it's fun to play with a portion. I tell my son to play with a portion, but do not make that a big portion of your portfolio unless you have unbelievably excess money and you can afford to lose 80% of it.
So, Jeremy, I guess we should not expect a Wisdom Tree meme stock ETF anytime in the future.
You know, we started with dividends. You know, we did dividend weighting the world 16 years ago. And it's, you know, coming back to those original ideas is all, you know, those funds are back in focus. High dividends, core dividends all around the world doing very, very well across the board. I think some of our relative performance numbers is the best it's been since we launched the firm is where you see those original ideas, very much tied to Professor Siegel's second book, The Future for Investors, which all was about high dividend value investing. I mean, we are certainly doing more things in thematics, and there are sort of thematics like cybersecurity or cloud computing and other things that we think are good secular growth stories and a sort of way to go in after sectors in a very different way. But, you know, I think that's been what's out of favor this year. It's all about dividends coming back.
And by the way, we should mention, you know, the new Biden buyback tax may do a little bit of a shift now towards dividends and away from buybacks. It's not a lot. It's a 1% tax. But at the margin, we expect a few firms to now make a decision to raise their dividend rather than to buy back their shares or to alter the proportion of each of those returns.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Well, Jeremy, maybe you can speak a little bit more about this, because I think you guys like dividend stocks in this environment. And I wanted to ask you what it is that makes them so appealing right now.
We've been talking valuations a lot, and I'll just stake with DHS, that high dividend, which has been leading performance. It's still at 11 times earnings, 11 to 12 times earnings. You're getting 8 to 9% earnings yields. And, you know, the professor often says, 20 PE, that's a 5% earnings yield. That's your long-term real return. Dividends grow with inflation over time. You go back 70 years, you know, the S&P 500 dividend growth was 2% on top of inflation. And so stocks have been this good long-term hedge versus inflation. And, you know, so if you could get 8 to 9% earnings yields and the earnings growth on these high dividend stocks, you know, usually you think of growth stocks for the earnings growth. The high dividend stocks are actually having higher earnings growth because, you know, they're energy heavy. That's the leading sector for earnings growth. So I think one of the things that's powering value and high dividends in particular is that earnings are growing faster than the market and faster than growth stocks right now.
Professor, I was reading an interview you did with our colleague Barry Ritholtz a couple years ago, and I know you've always been more of a stocks guy than a bonds guy. And back then you had said, you know, maybe 60-40 should be 75-25 these days. I'm curious what you're thinking about that allocation mix at this point. You know, if we have 10-year yields above 3%, is it, you know, is it time to go back to 60-40 or what?
Yeah, no. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. And it's not just me. And this is something that actually WisdomTree and I have been working on even way before the pandemic hit, that yields have dropped so low, and we'll talk about what they are right now, that you cannot get the type of draws that a retirement portfolio, a retiree needs from his or her retirement portfolio with a 60-40. The yields on bonds in real terms are just too small. Maybe the yields on stocks in forward looking are going to be a little less than historical, but they still way overwhelm what we get on bonds. Something else we discovered is that, and this was surprising, but that for many of the draws of a retirement portfolio, a higher percentage in stocks actually minimizes the probability, lessens the probability you're going to run out of money if you have a number of bad draws. A lot of people don't want to go to 75. They say, well, what happens? I get a few bad stock market declines. Well, it turns out that actually going more towards stocks and the actual income that you earn more than compensates you for the increased volatility of stocks during the time of the portfolio. So, you know, I strongly believe in moving from 60-40, 75-25, or 80-20. And by the way, I'm not impressed. I mean, so the 10-year is at 3.10. Well, if we get inflation down to 3, that gives you a 0% return. That's not attractive. And right now, returns are negative. Bond yields on all maturities are well below ongoing inflation rates. So, yeah, they've moved up, but we're far off from the world where tips were introduced. I remember that because I was often interviewed at that time. They were introduced, I believe, in January of 1997 at a 3.5% real return. That's the 10-year tips. And they subsequently almost hit 4.5% real return in 2000 at the peak of the technology bubble. So, you know, right now, and they're 0.47. So, and, you know, at the beginning of the year, they were -1. So we live in a very different world. Real returns on fixed income assets have dropped precipitously, and I do not believe they are anywhere going back to the old levels that they had achieved.
Yeah. You don't see any scenario with sort of positive real returns in the near future?
Well, our minimal positive, minimal, zero. No, nothing that I see. I mean, obviously the long bond will fluctuate. If bond yields go down, you'll get a nice capital gain. But as a buy and hold instrument, it's basically a zero or less real return investment.
And Professor, the podcast is coming out just a few hours before we hear from the Fed, from Powell at Jackson Hole. So I don't want to ask you about what specifically you're expecting from that. But maybe I can ask you just what, and I heard this question on from John Farrow on Bloomberg TV, just to give credit. But he's been asking people, what are your worries and your hopes and your wishes for from the Fed?
Well, this is what that's a very good question, Donna. This is what I hope for. I don't think that Powell is going to say 50 or 75. First of all, we've got a lot of data coming before now and the end of the meeting, in late September. We got another several price reports, another employment report, et cetera. What my hope is that he says many of the things I said at the beginning of this podcast, and that is, although we will continue to see higher inflation in the official statistics, we are seeing lower inflation on the ground in the sensitive commodity markets, in the housing market, in the freight market, in the cargo markets. And that is giving us hope that we could be much nearer to the end of this tightening cycle than the beginning of this tightening cycle. To me, such a statement would spark a huge rally in the equity markets. I don't expect him to make exactly that statement, but if he gives hints in that direction, if on the other hand, he says the situation is getting worse and we won't stop raising rates until we see the year-over-year CBI go down to 2 or 2.5%. Well, that's way overly hawkish. That'll be a big negative for the market.
Professor Jeremy Siegel and Jeremy Schwartz of Wisdom Trees, really appreciate your time. It's great to get your insights. We're not going to let you go until we hear the craziest things you've seen in markets this past week. But Professor, I have to ask you, hypothetically, if you're walking around Penn's campus and you come upon the father of a brand new freshman and he looks like he's pretty stressed out, Eddie, what advice would you have for him?
Calm down. freshman year is a little stressful for everybody. However, I think they're going to get through it. And certainly on the Penn's campus, they're treated really well and they're going to love it. And it's going to be a good 4 years for them and a good 4 years for you. And now you're going to have some vacation from your children, maybe more free time for you.
Well, I'll be down the road in Maryland, but I assume it's okay as a dad to call, if your kid gets a B, to call the professor and complain, right? Is that okay?
Well, I would, the professor would say, well, you take this exam, we'll see how you do.
That's a good answer. Yeah,
forget that.
If you get an A, I'll give her an A.
Fat chance of that. I don't know. She is an economics major, though, so we'll see. The dismal science. But with that, I think it's time for our crazy things, Valdana. What do you think?
Can I say the summer's been a little bit, you know, there's been like a little bit of a lull with crazy things or no? I had trouble finding one.
Hasn't been as crazy. I agree, which is maybe a good thing. Maybe we should count our blessings about that.
I did get a few.
But it sounds like you're lowering expectations a little bit.
I am a little bit. I did get a few, you know, a few listeners had sent some things in via Twitter, which I always want to encourage. But mine is about a Warren Buffett auction. He's auctioning a signed portrait of himself. It's, of course, going to charity. And the bidding has already topped $30,000. So I was thinking, okay, I mean, that's pretty good. However, it pales in comparison to, I think somebody paid $19 million earlier this year just to have a private lunch with him.
Yeah, so, it was his last private lunch. Yeah. I mean, he's been doing this for like 30 years, and he announced that was the last one, and then the price skyrocketed, you know, scarce resource all the way.
Right, I think he's turning 92 soon.
Well, there's a theme there. It's the experience economy versus the hard asset economy, I guess. A lunch with Buffett is worth a lot more than a painting
portrait of
him. Yeah. Well, it's something that you could, you know, tell your friends and children about for years into the future. I mean, Buffett is in his 90s. Am I correct?
He's turning 92 on August 31st.
92. Wow. Let me say, I will be very thankful if I'm as sharp as Warren is at 92.
I have a feeling you will be. And I hope Warren picks up the tab on that lunch, at least for that price.
They went to McDonald's.
How about you two? Have you seen anything crazy in markets recently, Professor?
I mean, you know, the meme is always fun. As you say, those meme stops are always fun to watch. Elon Musk is always fun to watch, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and what's going on with Twitter? It's a sideshow in many ways, you know. But I mean, I kind of watch that. You know, my son owns a Tesla, and so you know, I kind of see what's happening to that stock. You know, what is he going to step into next? I'll tell you though, I wouldn't mind taking some of the steps he's made. I'm not diminishing. He's quite an entrepreneur.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. How about you, Jeremy? You see anything crazy this week?
If I took one on a more serious note, you know, the European natural gas prices, the TTF Dutch prices hitting over 300 per megawatt hour. And I was in Maine last week and talking with a bunch of economists and macro people, and some of the discussion from the Texan crew, the people who are energy economists, were talking about how they could see a convergence between U.S. natural gas prices and European natural gas prices as U.S. becomes sort of marginal supplier and the pricings come together. So that's sort of a scary thought of like what's going on with what's going on in Europe feeding into to us.
Absolutely. What do you guys think? It seems like a recession's inevitable in Europe with that type of energy problem. Professor, you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's and it's a supply side, severe supply side. Induced one that seems even more severe than what you know OPEC imposed on the world back in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Not for us, but for Europe.
Yeah, and it hasn't even gotten cold yet in the fall and winter. It's going to be you know, potentially worse than a recession, a humanitarian crisis, perhaps, which is a scary thought. All right, well, I'll get us back onto the lighthearted stuff, Phil Donna. You might not be the appropriate age to have seen the Disney movie Cars. Did you see?
Oh, I've seen Cars. Isn't Lindsay Lohan one of the voices?
I think that's true. That's true. And as a matter of fact,
it's a good movie.
Does she play? I think she plays the character Sally Carrera in that movie, which is a cartoon Porsche. Porsche 911. So get this. So someone built a roadworthy replica of that car and sold it at auction, of course, because that's what you do. So an actual real-life version of Sally Carrera from the Cars movie sold at auction, and it's time to play The Price is Precise. I regret to inform you guys, you're now contestants on a game show, and you need to guess what the real-life version of the cartoon Cars Porsche sold for. And Valdana has to go first. What do you think, Valdana?
So we're playing Price is Correct, right?
Price is Precise, correct. I think. Price
I'm going to stick with correct.
All right.
I'll go with $250,000.
$250,000? How about you, Jeremy?
I was going to multiply that by at least 10, so like probably like $3 million.
No way.
$3 million?
No
Professor
way.
$3 million.
What's your bid
no
there?
Way.
I'm going to be between the two. I'm going to say 1.5.
All right. And this is why he's Chief Investment Officer, Jeremy. 3.6
He got
million.
It.
What?
2.6?
3.6. Can you believe that?
Oh, wow, Jeremy.
There's no way.
3.6. Well, this
that's why
I mean, Donna, that's a current car at 250. I mean, that's just
yeah, 250 price. Is.
I know, but how many fans are there? It's not one of Disney's most popular
yeah,
movies.
But it
think.
Doesn't matter. You know, someone saw it and yeah.
Yeah.
That's inflation.
Inflation, yeah.
And with that, I think that is all our time. Jeremy Siegel, Jeremy Schwartz, really appreciate your time, and I hope we can do it again someday.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Sonda.
It was fun.
Thanks for coming on.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heyrick is at Vildana Heyrick. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.